Spalding Gray became famous for his intensely personal confessional monologues like Sex and Death to the Age 14, Monster in a Box, Grey's Anatomy, It's a Slippery Slope, and Swimming to Cambodia, which was made into a movie directed by Jonathan Demme. Spalding was a charismatic performer who often talked about suffering from depression, and in 2004 he ended his own life. Now Nell Casey has edited his personal diaries under the title The Journals of Spalding Gray. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Casey to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
How did this project come about? How did you come to be the one to go through all the many thousands of pages of notes and journals?
Well, I met Kathleen Russo, who's Spalding Gray's widow, in 2006. I did a piece about a play that she did called Leftover Stories to Tell, and it was actually crafted from Spalding Gray's monologues to sort of tell the story of his life, and it had a few, actually, of his journal entries in it, too. I did a piece about it for the New York Times, and I interviewed her, and then she stayed in touch. I mean, actually, mostly I didn't hear from her until a year later. She came back and asked if I wanted to do a biography of Spalding Gray, but I remembered that she'd said he kept these journals, and I asked if I could read them.
Well, don't you come by this story naturally? You've edited Unholy Ghosts, Writers on Depression,
yeah,
and Uncertain Inheritance, Writers on Caring for Family.
Right,
and both of those
right.
fit perfectly into
There's
the Spalding Gray story.
There's a good intersection there, definitely. Yeah, no, he did struggle with depression.
Is it daunting to create a portrait of the interior life of a man who made so much of it public in his work?
Yes. And initially I worried that the journals would just be a repeat of the monologues, you know, that was my hesitation. But reading them, I realized there was this incredible life that ran beneath the monologues, that he had crafted a real character from them. And
Was he drawing from the journals for
yeah.
the monologues?
Well, he was, yes, drawing from the journals and his life. But there was so much more going on than he was saying in these monologues. And that was daunting, to try and find the story that had not yet been told as told by Spalding Gray.
Well, he was very funny in the monologues. Was he funny yeah. in the journals?
I feel he was very dark in a lot of them, but he had really very funny moments. I mean, I can probably remember some of them. I mean, for one thing, there was, you know, he had these incredible dreams all the time. He had these very, like, Fellini-esque dreams, and I can't really reproduce the very long ones, but a short one was he was standing in line waiting to be guillotined, and the guy next to him was Woody Allen. So, yeah. And he had other ironic moments and a sort of subtle irony and sense of himself.
The journals begin in 1967 when he was 25 years old and just getting his start as an actor. What were his thoughts on the kind of career that he hoped for?
Well, in the beginning, he was doing sort of traditional theater, and then he moved to New York in the 70s, and he actually in the late 60s, and then he got involved in experimental theater, and he was working. His girlfriend at the time was Elizabeth LeCompte, who still runs the Worcester Group today, and together they sort of started to collaborate and work on ensemble pieces that brought him closer and closer to the monologue form that he basically invented.
Writes on March 7th, 1967, "I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that I could never go on the stage every night and fake emotion." So he was questioning the right. role of an actor, at least as it pertained to him?
Yeah. No, he really did not like doing traditional theater when he was doing, you know, just regional theater. And then as he did this experimental theater, it sort of opened him up to start to figure out his own form. But he was always sort of searching. He had an identity crisis, although he had a kind of collapsing sense of self all the time. But he was always wondering what his job should be, even as a famous monologist.
Well, he's acting out the monologues. And then he did take acting jobs all along, didn't he? He would appear on television.
Yes.
On,
I mean, after
crime shows and,
right,
and the like.
And small parts in films. He was in Beaches and Beyond Rangoon. But he did that mainly after Swimming to Cambodia, which brought him, it was the monologue that brought him to sort of great fame and national recognition. And then he started to be asked to do these Hollywood roles, you know.
So he's writing these journals, the equivalent of a diary, or is this more like a writer's journal?
No, it was his diary. I mean, he made a commitment to himself to keep a diary. He had three nervous breakdowns in the course of his life. And after the first one, which was in the mid-70s, he decided he would keep a diary. His big central question in that breakdown was that he didn't really know how to make a decision for himself. He was allowing people to direct him and make decisions for himself or make decisions for him. So he decided to keep a diary at first of just, you know, have an account of his life to go back to make him to hold himself accountable to things. But then it just was a form that also fit him very well because he had so much life outside of his monologues that he wanted to narrate.
The decisions often were on the most basic level. I remember being at a party with him and the person he was with at the time. She would say, okay, Spalding, go down the left staircase. Okay.
Oh, you're kidding.
That door. Okay. They see the third car down there. That's the one we're going to. Okay. Duck your head.
It was, and obviously,
he both needed it and probably hated it.
I think needed it and hated it is an accurate way to put it.
But the depression probably comes naturally. He talked in his monologues, and he writes here about learning of his mother's suicide, something that haunted him for much of his life.
Yeah, it haunted him for his whole life, and then at the end of his life, it was actually the one story he told that was not. That he told himself that he could not use to save himself. The monologues sort of gave him an escape from depression, but the story he told himself of his mother's suicide sort of almost gave him permission in the end.
Had he always been aware of her struggle with mental illness?
Yes. She had breakdowns when he was very young. She had her own, mental collapses that landed her in the hospital.
And in the monologues, he often suggested that was a reason that he was so troubled.
Because
he had to struggle with thoughts of suicide.
Yeah, she had a big personality. She was vivacious. She was ebullient. He connected with her deeply, and so
more than
very,
his father.
Yes, his father was pretty removed, according to him, and to the brothers described him that way too.
Did his father support him when he was becoming well known?
I think his father, initially when Spalding was just sort of expressing a sense of theatricality in his childhood, his father sort of poo-pooed it and thought it was a silly way to be. And then later, I think his father sort of found it a foreign thing to be. I mean, I don't think he understood it entirely.
Did you ever meet him?
Spalding Gray?
Mm-hmm.
I did not. I saw him perform and I interviewed him once. It was one of my first magazine jobs when I came to New York was to interview him.
So were you surprised with what you found in the journals in relation to what you saw him perform and what he had said to you during the interview?
Yes. Well, in the interview, I barely could actually get my cue into the Q&A because he talked so fast and much. But the journals show this incredible vast life that he drew from to make his monologues. And the monologues were very perceptively done. I mean, he knew how far he could go for an audience, and he goes much farther in the journals. I mean, there are really, and it's interesting because he explores certain things that he didn't explore in the monologues. He had homosexual affairs. He only mentioned that once in a 1981 monologue and never again, though he does have them throughout his life in the journals.
You note that he didn't write much during the years he was becoming really successful with swimming to Cambodia.
Right.
Was that because he was just too busy doing other stuff?
Well, happy? Yes, right. No, I think I can only guess because the journals aren't there and I can't interview him to ask. But I think it was either that he was going, he was touring with Swimming to Cambodia for years and he was very busy. And there was no sort of narrative at the moment of his great success during that time. But then he looks back in the journals and with hindsight describes it as a turning point. And I think partly, he didn't know at the time what a great turning point it was in his career,
You mentioned that when he came to New York, he was first involved with Elizabeth Lecomte,
mm-hmm.
Who later was involved with Willem Dafoe. Then he moved on to René Szafranski, who both of them are directors.
Right.
Did it make things complicated that they had both romantic and professional partnerships?
You mean for Spalding to have had a romantic and professional partnership with both of them?
Both of those women who were both directors and producers of his work.
I mean, well, they had very different relationships, but they certainly played a big role. I mean, in shaping his profession. And so did Kathleen Russo. I mean, she was sort of a manager of types for him. I mean, he needed a woman, as you saw at the party, to help him when he had these sort of collapsing identity. He needed a woman mostly to come along and help him with his profession and his life.
When he was on the show in November 1990 to talk about Monster in a Box, he was a guest a lot of times.
I wondered, yeah.
He was performing at Lincoln Center at the time, and I asked him if he was ever going to marry René Szafranski, a question that he'd been openly exploring in that monologue for years, and this is what he said. Are you going to marry Renee?
Well, I think that the child issue, to have a child or not right now, is much larger than the marriage one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, the marriage, because that's what's on the top of the agenda of the marriage thing is, I'm sure Renee would like to get married. It's like a bit anticlimactic after 11 years. Maybe we should do it. I can't say why I'm not, outside of the fact that I would rather just do a personal agreement with her, with our lawyer, who's like a rabbi, really, with my lawyer, and not be a part of the traditional state marriage thing.
It's odd, and knowing what we know now, he did marry Renee,
right?
But Kathleen Russo was already pregnant with his child.
No, she got pregnant after they got married, after he and Renee got married. But I think at the point that you interviewed him there, he was about to meet Kathleen Russo. So there was, there was a lot of chaos going on. And the wedding to Renee, I mean, that's another point where he spoke about that in It's a Slippery Slope, his monologue about leaving Renee and going with Kathleen Russo. And that monologue has its boundaries and, you know, a sort of tidy sense of the narrative, because in the journals there's just an incredible amount of conflict and worry, and he's just freaking out the entire time he's about to marry Renee. And it's all very beautifully written, and incredibly searching, and it's not in his monologues.
So he writes beautifully in his own journals, even though he doesn't expect them to be published. I wonder what he would think about them being published.
Well, there are entries in the journals where he says, he speaks to an unnamed reader. He says, "Will you read this? One day, who am I speaking to? I think to you, reader." You know, so there's a sense that he's got some sense of self-consciousness in writing the journals. And then there's even an entry where he says to a director, who he's recounting the conversation in which the director asks him, "Who do you write your journals for?" And he says, "For my audience, of course. I have such a hard time having a non-narrated experience." But that said, you know, it's Kathleen Russo has, you know, told me that he talked about the journals of John Cheever and that he made it clear to her that he wanted a book like that of his own one day. So that's the closest we have to his permission.
And Nell Casey is here. She edited the journals of Spalding Gray, which is published by Knopf. He was badly hurt in a car accident in Ireland in 2001. How bad were the injuries?
Well, he was injured the worst of anyone, and Kathleen Russo was driving his head. They were driving in Ireland. They came to a spot that was apparently a famous blind spot and were hit by a truck. And he broke his hip. He had an orbital fracture. He ended up with a brace on his leg and a limp. He had, his forehead collapsed after the surgery for the orbital fracture, and he had to have plastic surgery. It was traumatic.
Did he have brain damage?
His doctors came to believe that he had suffered brain trauma. He also had serious depression, for which he had ECT. He really suffered. He did not recover from the car accident.
Did he write much in his journals at that time?
He after the accident, immediately after the accident, there are incredible notes that he kept in the hospital in Ireland. And then slowly but surely, he becomes so debilitated physically and emotionally that he doesn't write as much. He also became very obsessed at the end of his life. He became obsessed mainly with the fact that they had moved from one house that he loved to a house that he hated a mile away. In the Hamptons, and that's sort of when he began the mythic rant about his mother in his mind, about she had moved from a house she loved to a house she hated just before she committed suicide. And he starts to tell himself this story sort of over and over again. But in the end of the book, I end up narrating a good portion, because he did keep journals less and less, and less effectively, because he was so sort of traumatized physically and emotionally.
Well, what was the process of going through this and editing things out? Was it hard to decide what to take out and what to leave in?
Well, I read sort of everything that came to me. There were journals, there were tiny scraps of paper. He really seemed to have written on everything from, breast cancer pamphlets to Amtrak napkins. And
I mean, whatever he had a random thought,
write it down. He would write it. He was really kind of always trying to capture the thought and the life and the narration. But I read everything, and in reading everything, there were themes that emerged. There was a sort of sense of his life that came up as a kind of guideline and a map. And so I had to just make a big fat story of it and then keep winnowing. So, but I felt the themes helped to guide me.
Well, one of the previous books you edited, Unholy Ghosts, is about writers writing about depression. Did that help you in understanding the connection between Spalding Gray's creative work and his thoughts about depression?
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, that helped me understand. And also, just reading his journals was the greatest insight I could have had at all. But
did it sound like what other writers had said? Because
yes.
There are a lot of writers who've written about
depression, yeah.
Both regular depression and bipolar depression.
Yes, he refused in life to be considered manic depressive, but he certainly narrates bouts of mania in the journals, and he definitely had depression throughout his life. But the monologues, until a certain point in his life, until the end of his life, really helped him to sort of build a life raft out of depression.
People who are not depressives don't understand how somebody can be so successful, and he was, and at the same time remain depressed.
Well, he's a fascinating case. He was so prolific, and he was so depressed, but he wrote all the time, and he was also, the amazing thing about him was that he really felt best on stage. I mean, he was sort of the opposite of normal people. He was completely lost in life, but great on stage. He felt completely alive in front of the audience, so he wasn't made nervous by being in front of an audience. He was made to feel alive and I think, happy. So for him, performing and being prolific was an antidote to depression.
Well, in his later years, he also seemed to be calmer, more settled. Was it because of fatherhood? Did that bring him a certain peace?
Yes, I think, and he says this in the journal, said he had a good 5 years, you know, and he says that when after the accident, looking back, because he's worried that he's come to the end of his good 5 years. He was not perfectly calm about being happy. It gave him a great sense of unease and nervousness, but he was very happy when he became a father, and he writes incredibly about it.
Do you think that he committed suicide because of the accident, the aftermath of the accident, and feeling that he couldn't do what he had done in the past?
I think that's a big part of it, that he couldn't do he tried to do a monologue about the accident. I spoke to a lot of people who saw that monologue and felt that he was really having trouble coming back to his, you know, earlier sense of capability. Yeah, so he was not able to perform. He was physically really debilitated. He couldn't really exercise or walk, which was something he loved. He was very depressed and didn't have his normal form of monologue to get out of it. So, yeah, that was a big, big part of it, you know.
Nell Casey will be speaking tonight at 8 at the New School's Woolman Hall. As part of the Arts in Mind series. That's at 65 West 11th Street on the fifth floor. And she'll be speaking and signing books next Wednesday night at 7 at the Powerhouse Arena Books at 37 Main Street in Brooklyn. She'll also be speaking and signing books on Monday, November 14th at 7 at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble. For more information about all of those events, visit our show page at WNYC.org. And the book we're talking about is The Journals of Spalding Gray, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.